Welcome back to the Medieval Irish History Podcast. To support the podcast, please recommend to a friend. That's the best endorsement, really, that we can receive. Thanks, as usual, to Thiago, who produces the podcast with me, to the Department of Early Irish, Maynooth University for support and resources, and to Science Foundation Ireland and the Irish Research Council for funding our time and research. So today's episode was a really last minute addition to the schedule. You're going to have to wait 2 weeks for the planned episode on Sitric Silkenbeard, arguably the best Dubliner of all time. But when the Book of Kells hit the headlines yet again this week, we thought it would be a missed opportunity to not try and quickly record an episode on the topic, to perhaps address some of the debates that have kind of been brought up by all of this, and to try and answer some of the basic questions actually that people have been asking in the last few days, just about kind of the history of the Book of Kells and how and why it was made and that kind of thing. So very last minute, my guest, very kindly guest expert today, Dr. Donacha McGowan, was able to kind of give me a dig out at the last minute. Thank you very much, Donacha, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
And I'll introduce Donacha properly in a minute, but I just kind of wanted to say that this episode to me, in many ways, actually goes to the very heart of what the podcast is about. I was frustrated by the lack of accessible content and education for those with an interest in medieval Ireland. It's very difficult for many students, you know, like university students, to actually study medieval Ireland, and things like the Book of Kells are used by kind of Brand Ireland, to trade off of this golden period of our history, our self-styled kind of golden age, which is, we take so much pride in this period of early medieval Ireland. It's really kind of epitomised by things like the Book of Kells. But actually, the study of early Irish history is becoming increasingly marginalised within Irish academia. Irish history students, those coming here from abroad, can't easily access modules, courses on the period in which, Bridget, Patrick, Columbanus, Columba lived, the Book of Kells was created, the magnificent architectural sites such as Glendalough and Skellig Michael were built, and we're missing out on 8 centuries of rich history. Pangerbaun, a highly sophisticated legal system, Tonbo Coolna, Brian Boru, Cashel Armagh, Tara, the Vikings, the Anglo-Normans, everything. Okay. And the thing is that there's a quantifiable interest of students, tourists, businesses, politicians, in the general public, in this famed Isle of Saints and Scholars, where Vikings settled and, kings claimed Tara, and beautiful objects such as the Book of Kells were created. And that's part of the reason why I started the podcast in the first place. Okay. And one of the recent kind of controversy that I'm referring to in relation to the Book of Kells, it does bring these subjects to the fore. First of all, I roll my eyes a little bit and I go, yet again, it's this period in Irish history. It's some big, massive tourist draw that's hitting the headlines. Yet it's really hard for people to actually learn about, these things and about medieval Ireland. And it just asks big questions about accessibility. So the Book of Kells, it's widely regarded as Ireland's greatest historical treasure. This is how it's classified by UNESCO. UNESCO says it's one of the most spectacular examples of medieval Christian art in the world, and its fame rests principally on the impact of its lavish decoration, the extent and artistry of which are incomparable. So let's kind of talk about that today and maybe touch on some of these other issues. So as I said, my guest today is Dr. Donacha McGowan, who is an artist and an art historian, who recently published a gorgeous book called, make sure I get the name right again, The Book of Kells, A Masterwork Revealed, Creators, Collaboration and Campaigns. So you have been studying, Donacha, the Book of Kells and other early manuscripts for many years.
Yeah, for about, I suppose, more or less the past 20 years. A happy accident. It has been a wonderful adventure that has really taken over my life in all sorts of incredible ways that I would never have imagined.
So, Donnacha, I'm going to list out kind of some questions that people have been telling me. These are the things that they want to know, okay? I'm sure we won't be able to provide very clear answers, right? But between the two of us, we'll do our best, okay? So the kind of things, I'll list them all out and then we'll kind of lash into it and see what we can do, okay? When and where was it made? How was it made? How long did it take? Why? For whom? By whom? How many would have worked on it? Is it the best surviving of these texts, or is it just the most famous? Why is it so famous? What did the Vikings have to do with it? Always bring in the Vikings. Who commissioned it, like the benefactors? How did Trinity come to get it? I'm not sure if we'll be able to answer that very clearly. How does it compare to other works like those in the National Museum? And the various contexts, you know, that produced the book, the major churches, royal patronage, and that kind of thing, which is really my jam. I would also, though, before we get into that, just kind of ask you just a little bit, what attracted to you, bar the fact that the Book of Kells is gorgeous and you're an artist and an art historian, what attracted you originally to studying the Book of Kells?
Yeah, difficult to answer in a sense, but I suppose the first and most important thing to say is we would think, you know, the Book of Kells, that's just an ancient object. It's, you know, 1,200 years old. It's just a dusty old manuscript kept very safely. This is a vibrant work of art. This is a wonderful work of art, but one that's very difficult to see because it's a book. If you have a painting or a series of paintings, you can display them all at the same time. But with a book, you can only open... have two pages open at one time, although Kells is now bound in four separate volumes. It's substantial. Now each page is just a little bigger than the, now cut down to a little bigger than an A4 size.
But it would have been heavy, wouldn't
but,
it?
Well, I've been very lucky to have the facsimile. Had to get one to facilitate my study. And I should have brought it with me, really. It's a wonderful thing to have, and I love sharing it with people as well, because this is such a wonderful work of art. As I say, it's not just an object from the past. James Joyce, will tell you that 100 years ago, Ulysses, revolutionary piece of literature, was inspired by the Book of Kells. This is the power of any good piece of art.
Yeah.
And so I suppose it's that power that comes from any work of art, no matter what medium or form. It can just survive centuries and, as I say, inspire people. So I think that there's an element of that in my the way in which I was drawn to it. But
Sorry, that I will put in the episode notes. Obviously, I'll link to your book, but also, really, it's mostly from art historians that most of the attention, you know, has the published work on the Book of Kells, and people like Jennifer O'Reilly, Francoise Henri, Bernard Meehan,
Carol Farr.
Carol Farr.
Michelle Brown.
And then, exactly. You know, and I can give kind of links to some of them. And my own perspective is actually just that, the context that created it is what impressed me, and what an important object it became in history. And from the kind of the historical perspective, one of the books that I like to recommend is actually Richard Sharpe's edition, his Penguin edition of Adevinon's Life of Columba, where he kind of goes into a lot of how these things could have been created, you know, in Iona, the context, you know, one of the contexts perhaps that the book was produced. So I'll put up a link to that as well. And we will actually, I will say that we're going to have an episode with Thomas Owen Clancy from the University of Glasgow in June, talking about Columba and Iona. I'd say that there, that we're...
And mentioning Adevinon as well. The law of the innocents, protecting in a time of war, protecting the women and the children and the innocents. How important is that today when we look at what's happening in the world? And this was promulgated in Burr, I think, in 697. Yeah. You know, How far ahead of his time? The first Geneva Convention.
He's one of my other favourite people from medieval Ireland, Adamnan of Iona. But as I said, we'll do Columba and
another time.
And Iona first, and then we'll do Adamnan. But yeah, tell us then when and where.
So when and where
you mentioned 1200 years, and I've mentioned Iona, so I don't know what you can say about these two things.
No, we just literally there is no specific evidence to link it directly to any one site. Or any specific time, but in terms of its calligraphy, in terms of its art, it can be pretty well dated to around the time, a little bit before or a little after the year 800.
Okay.
And we can't be really, there's really nothing hard and fast that you can, with today's technology, hopefully in 20 years' time or less, there will be a technology that will say, oh, we can date that, we can identify the vellum or whatever, that they can actually, more specifically, and there may be ways of even locating it.
How did it get known as the Book of Kells, and if we can't say that it was definitely,
I suppose, the first recorded account of it, of this book, and we assume it's the Book of Kells, was that there was a gospel book stolen in the year 1007. This is recorded in the annals. A gospel, the greatest relic of the Western world, was stolen from the monastery in Kells. So that was the first time this incredible, presuming it was the Book of Kells, was mentioned in the annals. So that's kind of 1,000 years ago. But the Book of Kells was already a couple of hundred years old by then. So exactly when it would have come to the monastery in Kells, a lot of people, because Iona was the headquarters of the Columban monastic parochia, they would have assumed or kind of thought, well, that's probably where it was made. And it may have been made or partly made there, but we really don't know. I'm going to Port Mahomock. I'm flying to Inverness next Friday, and we'll be talking there. There's a Columban monastic foundation there where they have found vellum making. And some wonderful sculptural fragments, which are just kind of almost, you could say, straight out of the Book of Kells. And they make a case for saying, well, it's the Book of Portmahomock, the Book of Kells. And they're well entitled to make that case because it's a Columban monastery. Yeah. We found evidence of wonderful archaeological work there. They can make a very strong case that there is art, there is vellum making, and why not?
And again, in the Richard Sharp, in his introduction and notes to the edition of The Life of Columba, he goes into the amount of livestock you would have needed, calves, sheep, everything, the whole production. And Richard Sharp, was an expert on books and book
Fantastic
production and everything, of course,
scholar,
in the Middle Ages. There's a big industry underpinning the production of these books. I suppose the thing, would you agree that scholars kind of are settled that, listen, it's always was associated with this Columban Federation.
I don't think anybody argues with that. Yeah.
So it was the Book of Columba, or Book of Columbkill, which doesn't mean that Columbkill owned or wrote the book, but it's the Book of Columbkill. Basically, was an avatar. Yeah, exactly. For the same as Bridget is Kildare, Patrick is Armagh, Columba is Iona, Kells, and Derry.
Yeah.
And
it would say that for a long time it was known as the Great Gospel of Columbkill.
Yeah.
As was the Book of Durrow. And one of the suggestions is that maybe the Book of Kells was created to sort of upgrade a new shrine, an even better one. The Book of Durrow is a wonderful, wonderful book in its own right, but Kells just goes to places that nobody else can reach. I've often even had the kind of intuition that the individuals that created the Book of Kells had actually handled the Lindisfarne Gospels and saw, which is a wonderful manuscript, the Lindisfarne Gospels and said, which of course celebrates St. Cuthbert and the cult of St. Cuthbert, and that they said, hey, let's go home and make something even better for our saint, for Columba. We can't have, the cult of St. Cuthbert outshining Columba's cult. Yeah. And of course, the monastery in Lindisfarne was originally a Columban foundation in itself anyway. But the Book of Kells just goes to places that no other manuscript goes.
Okay, well then tell us, because there's obviously lots of tangents and there's lots of questions there that we need to answer or address. But yeah, go tell us about this. What is the skill really of the artist that produced it? That's what marks the Book of Kells out as so famous.
That's part of it. The scale of the ambition. Okay. I mean, I sort of mention in my book as well, you know, you have the great cathedrals, medieval cathedrals like Notre Dame in Paris or whatever. And there was a sort of a competitive element between the varying, each city as the new cathedral was commissioned and so on. You see it in Gaudi's Sagrada Familia as well. This ambition to create something just bigger and better than anything else. And the Book of Kells has all of that kind of ambition.
And is it incomparable? You know, is it the best?
It is, yeah.
I might
be
clear
biased.
Answer.
I might be biased. But it, you, and we'd say the art and the painting and the colour and the decoration kind of overshadows the script. The script on its own, as François Henri, the great, wonderful scholar of Kells back in 1974 in her monograph on the Book of Kells, suggested, you know, that even if it was only the script that we had, it would be an incredible book. Just the script. But you don't tend to see the script so much because of all the ornamented initials and the decorated pages and so on. There is so much art in there. The script gets kind of overshadowed a little bit. And that is, it's the most incredible calligraphy.
And you, even just all the, like, you know, the little images of like cats or different things on the different pages, as in every time you're looking for, you know, like PowerPoint presentations or, you know, like images from medieval Ireland, there's something is it's depicted in the Book of Kells somewhere. You know, you need an image of, you know, mother and child, or, you know, like it's just so, it's so full of different
and it had
drawings.
I mean, I did a paper on one occasion where there are emojis. They invented emojis, you know, little creatures displaying emotion. Quite a, you know, 1,200 years ahead of their time.
Yeah, sad face.
And they're, yeah, sad face, yeah. Terrified faces, you know, whatever. Confused faces in little animals.
What about face palm? That's the one that I tend to use the most.
absolutely incredible in so many ways. And there's humour in the Book of Kells. Not that it's a kind of a
comic book
or anything.
Do you know what we should have said,
like,
actually,
that?
Is what is in the Book of Kells? What is the Book of Kells about?
It's
that
the
should
four
have been
gospels.
My first question. It's the four gospels.
A lot of people, everybody has heard of the Book of Kells, yeah. But very few people know, and I've done.
I do
lots of talks to, you know, local history groups, library groups, and schools, and various. And as I said, I'm going to Inverness now to talk to the people in Portmahomock. But it's written. It's a gospel book of its time in Latin. So these are the four gospels: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The varying accounts of the life of Christ. There's a little bit of the Gospel of John missing at the end, but apart from that, it's more or less intact. Few bits and pieces missing here and there. And
it's not even a very good copy of the four Gospels. Is that fair? There's mistakes?
If you're a textual scholar, and there are those, you probably have colleagues who are just, you know, and Richard Sharp would have been a wonderful textual scholar himself. The people that just look at kind of, you know, what version of the Gospels are we getting here? And if you were just to correct the homework, if you like, of that, you can find all sorts of, say, oh, that's terrible, and oh, the Latin is terrible, and so on. But you need, well, and I'm not a textual scholar, but what I see is the work of somebody who is just creating, has set out to create just the most spectacular gospel book.
That was
this
the
is
aim.
God's
yeah, yeah,
word.
Yeah.
This is holy scripture.
Yeah.
And he's giving it, he and his colleague are giving it everything they possibly can.
But then it's not a practical book. They weren't actually using it to read from the gospels. They would have had.
I don't think in the sense of as a book for every Sunday in the altar. Possibly brought out for special occasions or to show to you know, distinguished visitors, whether that was a king or another cleric, a bishop or whatever, to impress. It was a very high status object that would have taken quite a lot of resources to create. You know, you mentioned earlier in terms of
so in itself,
vellum.
Which we don't really have time, we're supposed to get into now, but in itself it just is a really good example of how rich these churches were. How rich the particular church that produced this was, and how they would have, and we know obviously from other studies and contacts and my own work that I do, that the church was, you know, had very powerful, wealthy patrons that were funding these kind of things. So the, you know, the elites were working in tandem to create these objects. You know, the royalty, aristocracy and everything were
and
all
the royalty who controlled the area. Also, it was their kinsmen who would have controlled the monastery.
Yes,
you know, so
absolutely.
You had that in, you know, that's you're more expert in that field than I am, for sure. But
so why do you think the Book of Kells was created? I mean, you've said that you believe they set out to, we're going to make the best. Like, we're aiming really ambitious here.
In honour of our patron saint, our founding father, Columba. And now the possibility that it kind of chimes with the 200th anniversary of his death. Columba would have died 597. And then Book of Kells being made around the end of the 700s, early 800s. And you see the problem, again, you wanted to mention the Vikings. Most people are kind of agreed that with the disruption caused by the Vikings, that it wouldn't have been too much later than that.
Yeah, and we do have, I mean, this is the thing. So I suppose there's a couple of things to say about the Vikings. Yes, the Vikings disrupted a lot of things. And, you know, they kind of, the first records, the first written records are of these raids of island monasteries. And Iona got hit like hard a few times in the early 800s.
Correct.
Kind of obviously, because it was fairly remote, and was very wealthy and had
easy,
you know,
pickings,
had all this, you
gold
know, and,
chalices.
You know, and it was probably like even individuals more than objects that was probably, you know, the aim, or livestock and everything, to steal. But I have to, you know, make the point that the monastery or these churches and everything, they were being attacked the whole time, like before and after the Vikings and during the Vikings and by
it
each
might
other.
Have been the McCarthy's.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
we can't
like
blame
it was going on.
For everything.
We
you
can't
know, we
blame
had
them
lots
for everything.
Of,
yeah, it was going on all the time. But the annals are quite clear that Kells was kind of founded in response to a particularly big attack in a kind of 806 and 807.
Iona,
on Iona.
They did move their headquarters.
They moved. But Iona still continued as a really important church the whole time. It's not like they shut it down.
No.
and that Kells, you know, it was already a historically important site. Probably it's kind of like legendarily associated with these, you know, legendary figures like Con of the Hundred Battles, Con Cead Cathach, brilliant name, you know, and Cormac MacArch. You know, so yes, there's definitely a response to, you know, a Viking, you know, a particularly bad Viking raid, and, you know, that maybe the book had been started in Iona and then they, you know, brought some of these precious objects to this new church. But they had a kind of a network of these, you know, churches.
And that would fit, actually, even though, as I said, there's no specific evidence to locate it here or there. But I have identified some hiatus in the production of the Book of Kells. So the received wisdom is that there was a big team of scribes and artists, and that's where I set out as an artist, as a teacher. I always felt, well, you know, I can identify Niamh's work, I can identify Tiago's work. If I see a piece of paper on the floor, I'd say, oh yeah, sure, I'd recognise Niamh's DNA, if you like, in her artwork, even if it was only a little scribble or whatever. And I felt, well, you know, if you sit down, you can actually, and take your time, and this is what I set out to do. So there was supposedly four scribes, maybe three or four artists, maybe some of them were the same, you know, the same people. And I said, well, if you sit down and take your time, you can actually figure this out. And that's what I set out. I didn't think it was going to take me about 15 years of my life, but I fell into that rabbit hole, and really I'm only crawling out of it just now. And I could only find two people.
Okay, so
A whole team. With lots of variation, but you'll have to read the book.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned to you earlier, it's free online, so you don't even have to buy the book.
Yeah.
You can.
You go through it all in painstaking detail.
Yeah,
we're just getting the.
I do hope someday to be able to write a kind of an accessible version, because it's a great story of these two individuals who work together. One is this incredible artist, and the other is maybe more theologically educated, and he's this incredible scribe. And they're working together. There's elements of collaboration and even of mentoring. But the great artist disappears. Now, I'm assuming he has probably died. Now, that could have been a plague. my dentist suggested maybe the two of them had a row. And that's a possibility. But the more likelihood is, you know, was it a plague? Was it a raid? Was it a Viking raid? Or was it a battle with the neighbouring...
angina.
Whatever. Yeah. Or just old age or whatever. Yeah. And
so many things were there to kill you.
He's not quite as well as he had been. He's either older, more frail, has suffered injury or illness. The eyesight might be failing. The hand may be shaking a little bit more. Mm. And he tries. Doesn't quite succeed, but he tries desperately hard to finish their great masterwork. And gets most of it sorted.
How long do you think it would have taken them?
That's a good question.
If it's just two lads.
Two lads, yeah. Well, they can be working together, you know, they don't have to wait for one to finish. They can both be working simultaneously. And it really depends to what extent they would be free from other monastic duties. Did they have priestly duties? Did they have, you know, farming duties or whatever they might have to do within a monastery? Were they then able to work all year round?
I presume they wouldn't. As in, I presume they would have been, they wouldn't have had any other duties, but they would have had to attend the different
the monastic hours. They'd have had to do all of that. Right. But then, weather-wise, could they work? I mean, I've been in Iona. I was there on a lovely May day, weather like this, a few years ago, and it's a wonderful place, but I can imagine in the middle of winter, you wouldn't be... you know, or any monastery, I'm not saying it was made on Iona, but any primitive structure that they would have had in the sort of 8th, 9th century. Yeah. You know,
pre-electricity, pre-industrial revolution. Yeah.
Could you work in the wintertime? So were they limited just to working in the fine weather? Mm. So it's difficult to pinpoint, but I could see it being done if they had a, you know, were given a pretty much free rein to work on it. I could see it being done over a period of, you know, 3-4 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if they were maybe older then when they were doing it, they would have, at this stage, were highly accomplished. They must have produced loads of other stuff to get to this point.
So much has disappeared. Of skill. We don't have any, we really don't have any, they have found fragments of things here and there that are very close and very similar, and similarities with the Durham Gospels have been spoken of. And of course, Lindisfarne, as I mentioned earlier, is a close relative, an older relative, an ancestor, if you like, of the Book of Kells, as is the Cathach in the Royal Irish Academy. Again, another wonderful book.
Yeah.
And I talk about how that may have been a Columban book and how that may have been, you know, channeled into as elements in the Book of Kells as well. But I spent a wonderful week in the Bodleian Library with the MacGregor Gospels, and I've actually, in an appendix, I've actually written an account of the paleography there. I think I'd like to think I've added a little bit to our understanding of the, you know, paleography of the MacGregor Gospels. Yeah. I spent a week in the
Vatican. Are they in good condition?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I mean, it's so wonderful. Yeah. You get this book, and of course, very, very carefully. Mm. Open these pages and you see the marks that were made 1,200 years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've had similar experiences.
Well, I've had just there recently. Yeah, I was in Florence and I was in the Laurentian Library and I was looking at these 12th century manuscripts. So not as old as you know, we're talking about 9th or even you're talking there about some earlier centuries. But these manuscripts that they just like, nobody in Ireland is going to just let you. Now, you need to have just show that you're researching this work.
Yeah,
And then, you know, you have access to them and you can't like run off and take it home with you or anything. It is frustrating when people who are trying to study these, you know, texts. So you've mentioned about you're talking about the similarities with the Cathach or the Durham Gospels or the, you know, the Book of Duro and all of these kind of things. If researchers don't have access to these, it's really hard for us to answer any of these questions.
Totally, yeah. And that has been very much, sadly, this is a recent phenomenon, really, within certain institutions that the, you know, access is completely denied. I mean, whether one agrees or not with the conclusions of my study.
It's going to be hard for someone to dispute it.
But I mean, I didn't have any access.
Yeah, okay.
I managed to do it. I had access as a tourist, and this was in the older display when they had two books open, two of the four. It's broken into four for each gospel now, bound in that way for conservation reasons, which is ideal. So I was able to lie on this plate glass table and spend hours gazing at these four pages. The more recent display now is kind of Mona Lisa at a distance. You just pay your 20 quid and walk past, and you know, you can't study it, you can't gaze on this page, you can't linger over
it. So it's going to be so hard to answer all of these questions. And
they've been, you know, I think I've mentioned to you previously about my, I was I had been to the Bibliothèque Nationale a couple of times in Paris, and I had, you know, registered as an accredited scholar researcher, as you were saying, and so I was back another time, and I was hoping to see something else in the Cabinet des Médailles, but that was closed. And I said, oh, what'll I do? Oh, I'll just have, I'll just see if they have the microfilm of the Eternal Gospels, which I had seen there before. Now, that was prior
which
to the digitization.
Gospels are another
brilliant. So I asked the person, I said, you know, I looked at this before. Can you give me the facsimile or the microfilm? And she said, oh, I'm terribly sorry. We don't, we no longer have the microfilm. But she said, would the original do?
I was
sort of gasping or trying to contain yourself, and you're sort of, well, maybe if that's all you've got, you know.
Poker face.
Yeah. So I didn't actually, because the keeper of the manuscripts was out that day, she said, oh, you'll have to come back tomorrow. And I came back the following day thinking, well, this is not going to happen. But there was the Eternal Gospels, because I was an accredited researcher, you know, I was a genuine researcher. And there was a young German student there looking at some fragments of Japanese manuscripts, and the librarian was telling her, oh, I have more of these, would you like, you know, because the librarian was there excited that there was somebody interested in the holdings of the library and wanted to share that with the researcher, wanted them to be, you know, people to learn more.
Like, this actually gets me a little bit emotional, because Why would these things be, you know, behind, you know, lock and key? Like, would you only, this again, the pocket, would you only be delighted, you know, to share your knowledge and your interest in the subject?
And I managed to, I managed to complete my study and ultimately, luckily, get it published.
Yeah.
And as I said, that's available even to read on free online. But what I'm actually, the work I'm doing now is to try and make sure that the next generation of scholars won't have the struggle that I had, that they will be encouraged to study. Because my work, I hope it makes a contribution, but it's up to the next generation with new technologies, new science, you know, to take it, to and challenge my
absolutely work. And listen, I just say, like, it is complicated, because you mentioned the Cahuc, you know, which is quite damaged and everything. And, you know, these institutions, they do put a lot of effort and resources into conservation, which, you know, is priceless in a way. So there's a balance there, I think, that we can strive for, where we're not putting up boundaries, that we're encouraging people to, you know, engage in kind of interest and research, and even small things like, I say small things, but, you know, like charging people, you know, to see something that's being promoted as, you know, a national treasure, when the National Museum is free in Dublin and has so many amazing artifacts. Again, so, you know, these are all publicly funded institutions. Ultimately, the taxpayer is actually, you know, paying for all of these things. So maybe the taxpayer should be allowed see. But, you
this
know,
is our
bearing,
heritage.
It's our
this
heritage.
Is your
yeah.
heritage. It's
bearing
my heritage.
In mind, as I said, practicalities and logistics.
Of course.
Costs go into these things.
Yeah.
Like the Royal Irish Academy, for example, like, you can, it, you know, it is open to the public, you know, you not absolutely freely, and, you know, you go in, you know, you ask for
make
permission, you
whatever,
make an appointment, you know, but it's there in the Cahuc, which is in rag order, you know, but you can see, in theory, some of these just unbelievable.
Well, I think if you have a reasonable scholarly, you know, reason for seeing,
there's
something,
there's no barriers there. They're only happy to.
And, I mean,
oblige.
As I said, I've had that in Durham and Paris and
the Bodleian
and the Vatican.
Yeah.
You know, you just, when you present your case, and they say, oh, no problem, here you are. And I mean, of course, you take the greatest of care.
Yeah.
And as I said, it is such a privilege, you know, to see. And, you know, as wonderful as the digital facsimiles, or even, I have the hard copy facsimile as well, as wonderful as they are, there is nothing quite like seeing and, you know, just being up close and personal with the original marks that were made, you know, whatever, 1,200 years ago.
Tell me then in the Book of Kells, right? And obviously you were only able to look at it underneath glass, yeah, unfortunately.
Mm. Well, that was valuable.
But is it, tell me, like, how high is it off the page? Do you know what I mean? Like, is it very smooth? You know, like when you see a Van Gogh,
yeah,
in person, you're like, whoa.
The texture of the surface, yeah, and that. Yeah, yeah, some of the paint is you know, does stand up from the surface, but not as much as later manuscripts,
okay,
will say, which were where you had initials that were built up with gesso and then would have had gold leaf applied. They're actually quite, bumpy on the surface, but there would be a little bit, but it's not an impasto surface, I think maybe would be the term,
okay,
you know, in terms of a richly textured, painted surface. It wouldn't be huge in that sense, but because the pages then would compress each other,
yes,
a book, it wouldn't have that much of a height of paint, if you like, from the surface.
So if we get back to the two lads who you claim created it, so they would have been skilled artists who probably created lots of other stuff which doesn't survive, because I don't know if everybody knows this, but such a tiny fraction of our manuscripts,
absolutely,
survive.
Yeah.
And again, not just because of the Vikings.
Totally. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Fires. It was fires all the time.
And things were written over. Books were, because vellum was, yeah, valuable and, yeah, precious, and, you know, a rare, well, I won't say a rare commodity, but an expensive commodity. So you'll often find.
Tell us about vellum, and just a tiny bit.
Well, it's a calf skin. Yeah. I mean, there were. It's kind of not too distantly removed from making leather,
okay,
in a sense, and it's, as such, it's quite sturdy. But there's a colleague of mine now who's working in the Portmahomock project, actually, Thomas Keyes, and he's making, he's using deer because he has access,
okay,
to culled deer,
okay,
from an estate which is on the grounds where he's actually living. But it would have been calfskin. Ireland at the time, and Dennis Casey, of course, has done wonderful work on the calfskins and the number of cattle and the size of the herds that would have been required and so on. So cattle was the big, if you like, that was the mainstay of the economy 1,200 years ago in Ireland. And so it was calf skin would have been used, and the skin of very, very, so the finer vellum would be made from the skin of very young calves.
So it's very sturdy.
But it's quite,
paper. Nothing like as flimsy as paper is.
Absolutely not, and won't deteriorate in the same way and so on. But of course it needs conservation.
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, it's, you could say, as tough as old boots, you know,
in
another way.
Yeah. So we don't have kind of the stuff maybe that they might have, or do you? Do you have any theories? Do we have other stuff that might have survived from these two artists? No, nothing you could attribute to them.
I don't think anything that you could really say. And of course, they must have learned their craft, and they must have done other. But every monastery had at least one gospel book and one Psalter as well, the Book of Psalms.
Okay.
So every, and individual, even ecclesiastics might have had their own copies, or they would have made. Of course, there was the great legend of, Finian.
Yes, of course.
And Columbkill supposedly making
Finian
the copy.
Influenced everyone.
To every cow, its calf, and to every book, its copy.
The first example of copyright law in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, that would be from Ireland. We can talk about that another day, maybe.
Another time.
Yeah. So tell me, so loads of work would have been gone into the book before the artists even got to it. So it was expensive straight off. And what are the distinguishing features? We've all seen images of just this richly illuminated, initials and stuff.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, and as Francis Henri said, you know, the script alone is just majestic. This is just gorgeous. And my study has taken me into looking at every single letter form, literally every page of this, and it's just mind-bogglingly full of variation, all sorts of subtle little variations from page to page and from word to
word. What's your favourite page, or your favourite feature?
Oh my God, do I have a favourite?
We say page, I suppose folio, but
well, that's,
do you have
on,
a do you have a,
you
do you have,
you,
a
you have children, you
go
can't
on. I, I, you know. David Stifter gave me his Professor Stifter gave me his favourite word. Do you have a favourite image? No?
I had to look up Sanatavit.
Oh, is this a tattoo?
This is a tattoo. This
so
is my,
for all of the people who can't see us.
This is my wife's name.
That's
and
it.
I had to find the name Anita doesn't occur as such, but I knew that the term sanitavit, to heal, occurs in many places. Jesus healing the whatever.
In the Book of Gals.
In the Gospels, and of course it occurs in the. So I was able to get that, and then I took one of the initials. And that's one of the things as well that I've done, as well as my book. I have a little website, and I have, because I had created a database of all the initials. So for all the tattoo artists out there, you can see all the A's, you can see all the B's, and they're, well, I think they're fun. I don't know if anybody else does. But
yeah, do you have any other Book of Kells tattoos?
No, I don't.
That we can't see? This one is on his wrist.
On my wrist. So this is my wedding band, if you like.
Okay.
Yeah,
oh,
for Anita.
That's so romantic.
Who, I should say, edited everything wonderfully.
Does she have a tattoo at your...
No.
Okay. <Which? laughs> We better move on. Donnacha, as an artist, in addition to being an art historian, but tell me, if someone was to try and create something like the Book of Kells today, you know, would that be easy? You know, like, if someone created that now, would we be equally like, wow, this is an unbelievable piece of art? Like, does it stand the test of time in that regard?
Oh, absolutely. There is a big project in, I'm just trying to think of the name of the university in America. They are doing, they have a number of artists and calligraphers involved in the creation of a gospel book, which is a fantastic creation in itself. I've been working a little bit with a calligrapher artist from just outside Barcelona, who has no Irish connection at all, but again, has come under the spell, if you like, of this incredible Book of Kells, and he's able to work in a way that I haven't seen in anybody else's work. He's able to work at the level of detail that the finest, that you find in the finest work, pages like the Cairo page or the eight circled cross page, and I have some of his work now. It's a pity I didn't bring to show you today, and I share that with people when I show them. I do events with the facsimile. I love, you know, like yourself, and what you're doing in your podcast here. I love sharing you know, the knowledge and the facsimile. I do it during Culture Night and Heritage Week and so on. You can have maybe four or five people gathered around, and I also show them examples of... Josip Batley is the name of the artist, and it's just phenomenal.
So you're saying that his skill is kind of unsurpassed, that he is just able in 2024 to recreate what these guys were doing in the year 800?
Doing it, and he's doing a video. I've been helping him with the voiceover for that as well, and so on. His English isn't
so
great.
So it's incredibly difficult, is it?
It is, and phenomenal to see what he's doing. It's really, really wonderful.
But that's just amazing that, so, you know, that I suppose accounts for why the Book of Kells is still so famous. That it's, there aren't...
Well, it's one of the reasons.
There
anyway.
Aren't many pieces in the world that you can see that have this level of artistry.
Have that level of detail. No, wow. it's quite phenomenal in that sense.
Okay, amazing. What were the other things kind of that people wanted to know? I mean, I know a lot of people have been asking, like, how come Trinity have it now? Like, listen, that's kind of... You know, really interesting early modern history and colonial history. You know, I suppose Trinity came to have it in the 17th century.
Mid-17th century, you know? Somewhere. We're not exactly sure, but at the Cromwellian times, it was kind of, let's get it out.
Sent for protection.
Protection, yeah.
And that was kind of standard enough, and I kind of over those centuries and stuff, there was kind of different objects were going around.
I mean, you know, when Henry VIII, you know, took over the monasteries, there was incredible destruction.
Yeah.
And only for the sort of, you know, prescience of certain individuals who kind of kept things like the Lindisfarne Gospels and protected them and kind of kept them away from the iconoclasts who were going to get rid of all these things and burn them and knock them. And
so many things were destroyed.
Oh, so much has been destroyed. Absolutely. I mean, it's a miracle in a way that the few that we have survived, and it's so wonderful. But I mean, so much has been lost.
How does it kind of compare to different works that we, you know, you mentioned the Book of Duro, you mentioned Durham Gospels.
Excellent.
Is it seen as the, you know, pinnacle of all of these illuminated manuscripts?
Well, again, I'm biased, of course, but And my supervisor, Michelle Brown, would be the great authority on the Lindisfarne Gospels. Yeah. And of course, but, you know, when you put them side by side, and again, I mean, it's like people, like any work of art, it's not really a contest that one is better than the other. The Lindisfarne Gospels is an incredible
They're different.
Piece of art.
They have different
but
aims.
The scale of ambition.
Yeah,
the scale of ambition and what is realised in Kells, just they really reached for a whole new level.
But you say that, but there are holes in some of the
That's one of the strange anomalies in Kells. The Lindisfarne development, Lindisfarne is almost perfect. There are a few little holes here and there. That's part of the manufacture process of creating vellum. It's a bacterial breakdown. People thought it was warble fly and things like that. But my friend now again that I mentioned in Port Mahomock, Thomas Keyes, who's making vellum, well, making parchment, a kind of vellum from deer skin, you know, and he's very, very, he's doing this all the time, and he reckons it's just the bacterial process, and it's about timing. You need to take it out. You need to stop the process of removing the sort of flesh and so on from the animal
skin. The holes
skin
would have been incorporated
into
it.
They occur at a certain point in that.
Okay.
So, but the unusual thing about Kells is that there are quite a lot of holes. For as wonderful as the art and the script is, the actual vellum itself is quite flawed in places. And they seem to have, well, were they limited in what was available to them, or did they accept that as a part of the humility of their monastic devotion, that they took the animal skins they were given and just worked around the holes that were there? So I don't know. It is one of these kind of strange
anomalies. Does that make the work of those artists then even more impressive? That
in a way,
it's not like they were just handed the most, you know,
perfect,
pristine, perfect. It was like, well, it's your job to.
And whether they, I mean, it's possible that they made the vellum themselves.
Okay.
But maybe there were parchmenters or people who were, you know, other craftsmen who were making that. Again, that's one of the imponderables. We just don't know.
Yeah.
Did they make their own vellum?
What do you think of this theory? I know Dovi O'Cronin was suggesting an Ulton that was mentioned in a Northumbrian.
There's this, and I suggest he's maybe a kind of ancestor of the type of work that we get in the Book of Kells, this variation.
Okay.
There's an account of this wonderful scribe, Ulton, an Irish monk. But tantalizingly, we don't have anything specific that we can attribute to him. You know, maybe something like the Durham Gospels. I think Dovi suggests that he might be involved. But again, that's speculation.
Yeah.
And we just don't know.
It's so annoying that they didn't sign their names to everything.
And well, when you do get a signature on an ancient manuscript, you have to be very careful, because there's nothing, 200 years later, signatures were added just to say, oh, well, this is Colum Kills' book, you know, to increase its fame and its value and its status. And so you have to be very, very careful about what they call colophon inscriptions. But in Kells, anyway, the sort of about 10 pages or so at the beginning and maybe 10 pages at the end are actually completely missing. So that's where you would have expected to find you know, if there
and
was
did they go
an
missing when it was well, inverted commas, stolen, because I don't know if it was an inside job in 1007 or 1006, but or when I know it was rebound and stuff in later centuries,
of course,
and we lost a lot of leaves then.
Cormac Burke has written a very interesting paper. I came across an interesting paper that he has written about the stealing of the manuscript from the monastery in Kells, and that there may have been a sort of, that it wasn't just necessarily a random theft, you know, for the valuable cover or whatever, but it may have had to do with sort of the status and the ownership and the I can't even cite the entire argument that he makes just now. I just had a quick look at it, but it's a wonderful interpretation of it in terms of the kind of politics of the time and the symbolism of, you know, that it was hidden under a sod. And he goes into all that it wasn't just necessarily found in a, you know, dumped in a ditch.
No.
That there was a symbolic something symbolic going on in that whole act, and had to do with control and power and leadership and who was the, you know, was it Armagh, was it
Kells? Well, this is around the same time that Brian Boru was up in Armagh getting his name signed into as Emperor of the Irish in Armagh.
When it was stolen, of course. Yes, absolutely.
It was signed, you know, so his, you know, Imperator Scotorum was signed into the Book of Armagh.
Right.
And of course, the all of these, you mentioned the cover, it would have had an absolutely stunning shrine, which would have been potentially even worth more than the, you know, the book itself, as in the artistry
to
and the
those who would
metals.
Only be interested in gold and silver, obviously. It's priceless.
The Word of God, ultimately, is the thing that was being venerated and glorified.
But you mentioned about the when the pages would have gone missing. And I, in the book again, I go into, you know, I argue in detail why I think that's not when these pages went missing at all. They went to my, and again, I make the argument in my own research and book, that they went missing while the book was being made, because the what is now the very first page of the Book of Kells, I argue, was repurposed.
Okay.
The pages had gone missing, were ripped or gone or lost
Which
or
happens.
Burnt in
we
a fire
that it, yeah.
or whatever.
Yeah.
Really don't know, but they're gone missing. And the surviving member of the two-man team repurposes that page, which is now the first page. It's a very
strange
page.
And you call
this
about two different campaigns.
I do.
So this was the second campaign.
After the hiatus, whatever that was, and he repurposes this. This is a, the very what is now the very, very first page of the book is has a, you know, strange feeling to it. And I can identify elements of work that belong to what I call the second campaign on that page. And I think those the missing pages, at least from the front, went missing at during the phase or the time in which it was produced, not when it was stolen from the monastery in Kells. And I must revisit that article by Cormac Burke. Have you come across that yourself?
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
really interesting yeah. And makes an awful lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know,
definitely. There's always so much more going on. Because
this is,
the thing is that these objects were... you know, they were venerated as relics in themselves. They were kind of insignia. They were
emblems of power. Absolutely.
And as you said, you know, they were initially created for that reason, as in to glorify the Word of God, but also their patrons, their royal patrons, but also the founder of their community. So in this case, Columbkill. And, you know, there was a little bit of a, you know, kind of like, you know, teams, you know, versus, you know, like Armagh versus Kildare versus Glendalough versus, you know, Kells/Iona,
and
you know,
maybe even the Book of Armagh and the Book of Kells were actually, you know, it was a battle of the books,
And
potentially between Armagh and the
Columban. The Book of Armagh was an incredibly important emblem kind of insignia of Patrick and Armagh, but it's not an illuminated manuscript. It's a much more valuable manuscript for me because of all of the text that it contains, the actual like historical information, and the text and everything are so valuable. And it was on display next to the Book of Kells in Trinity.
Well, that was the, in this big under this big plate glass table.
Yeah.
You had the Book of Doro, you had the Book of Armagh, and maybe the Book of Dima, I think, as well. And you'd have two of the books.
Because they're all
of
from
Kells.
The same kind of context, so it was good to have them together.
And I would spend hours.
Yeah.
Now, you had to kind of, I stepped out and she stepped in again with the busloads of tourists.
Know.
You step back when the crowd came in and oohed and aahed for a few minutes, and then they moved through, and then you went back and...
We've run out of time, Dulacha. And there's obviously, we've only touched on about half the things, but we got the recording studio for just a little snippet of time. Last minute, we're recording on Thursday, the 9th of May. And you were so good to be able to come up and to chat to us. And at least we've maybe started, you know, a bit of a conversation on this that we can take up again another time. And hopefully we've answered some people's questions.
Or stimulated them to go study
it yourselves, everybody. It's such a rich part of our rich heritage.
Thank you for the invitation. I mean, I'm delighted, absolutely honoured and privileged to be here.
It was just always lovely to chat with, you know, to chat with someone about these things. As I said, I'll have a link to your book and to other resources as well in the episode notes. So thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you for listening. Please email medievalirishhistory@gmail.com with any questions or comments, or contact us on X at Early Irish Pod. The best way you can support us is by following the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and by rating the show. 5 stars is always appreciated. Thanks.